Hello and welcome to the Brentas Foundation podcast, where we throw light on some of the African continent's biggest and most pressing issues and leverage best practice, not just on what to do, but how to do it. I'm your host, Marie Noah Ngoklo, and it's a pleasure to share in this moment with you. Okay, so today I'm joined by someone I've been strategizing about for so long, and I'm so glad he's here today. Seated across from me is none other than Tendai Biti. Mr. Biti is a Zimbabwean politician who serves as the second vice president of the Citizens Coalition for Change, CCC. He previously served as Zimbabwe's Minister of Finance from 2009 to 2013, during which time he was named the 2011 Best Finance Minister in Africa by Euromoney Emerging Markets for stabilizing and setting the Zimbabwean economy on a growth trajectory. I don't know if you remember that time, but it was a big deal. Inflation was out of this world. Tendai is also the senior partner at Tendai Biti Law and previously spent 18 years at Zimbabwe's oldest law firm, Honey & Blackenberg. For me, the opportunity to sit with people like this is a part of sharing in their legacy and the lessons from a life of service. We touched on democracy and its future on the continent, why it's important to serve, and how to stay motivated when the going gets tough. For those interested in the African political landscape, this is a must listen to. So let's head straight into the episode with Tendai Biti. So Tendai Biti, thank you so much for sitting with me today. I've been waiting for this day for a very long time. So thank you for doing this with me. The first thing I wanted to ask is, you know, what personal experiences or moments motivated you to get involved in politics and governance?
I think I've always been an individual with a great sense of justice or injustice. So right from the early days when I was literally at a secondary school, things that were fair or unfair to me would stick out and I would speak out. So I remember that as early as 13 or 14 was when I was at Form 2, that is when I led my first protest or a demonstration. I was at a boarding school and they'd fed us with milk for like 2 weeks, you know,
milk.
Yeah, so I just went and with little boys from twos, and we started bellowing like cows, moo, moo, moo. The headmaster had to be called, and the headmaster then says to the kitchen staff, "Why are you feeding these kids with milk? We buy meat and so forth." So there were changes. So it's basically really an extension of, so my life has really been an extension of that. At university, we called ourselves the voice of the voiceless. We led huge demonstrations, particularly against corruption and so forth. Then my work as a lawyer was just also basically public interest litigation, fighting injustice. I went into politics just as an extension of that. So I actually don't consider myself a politician, but a human rights activist.
That's amazing. Tendai, can you tell me a little bit about the first time you heard you were becoming, you know, Minister of Finance and your first day in office? What was that like for you?
Well, firstly, it's a very long story, but I'll cut it. Yeah, so I was the chief negotiator of our party, the Movement for Democratic Change, led by the late and great Mokgen Tsvangirai. So in the process of negotiating, when we concluded, I realized that these people were not bona fide. So I told Morgan that we shouldn't get into this government because the people were not bona fide. But there was pressure on Morgan from ordinary Zimbabweans who we had suffered. Remember, inflation was 500%. We're saying, get in there, you might soften our life. There was also pressure on Morgan from other colleagues in our party who wanted the trappings of power, being minister and so forth. So I actually ran away and disappeared. You know, so Morgan spent like 3-4 days, he couldn't find me. Yeah. So using my close friends, he eventually tracked me and he invited me for for dinner. So we went for dinner at some Chinese restaurant in Avondale in Harare. And then he says, I'm going to appoint you as Minister of Finance. So I told him that, look, I don't want to be a minister. I don't want to be part of this government. So he then says, we then agreed that I would consult my family.
Mm.
It was on a Tuesday. I would consult my family and then come back to me. I woke up on Wednesday morning and Morgan had announced that I was going to be Minister of Finance. So I couldn't embarrass him and say, you know. So my friends then came to me and says, look, Tendai, you are in a catch-22 situation. If this government fails because of your influence, they'll blame it on you. So you have no choice but to get in. But anyway, so I accept to get in. We were sworn in on Friday, the 13th of February, 2009. And I started work on Monday, the 16th of February, 2009. So I get into the ministry. They pointed out to me. I didn't even know where it was. And I walked in a long, narrow corridor. If you've read the Joseph Conrad, The Heart of Darkness, the opening chapter when... you know, Mr. Keats is going to Africa and he's going to the colonial office and people are looking at him like crazy. Where are you going? What are you trying to do? You want to go to Africa? That's what these people
that's what it felt like.
Yeah, have doors open, peeping in a poorly lit corridor. So I get in, I'm shown my office, so I sit. So a few minutes later, the top brass of the ministry comes, the permanent secretary, Willard Manongo, a fine gentleman, and other people. So there's a budget director called Fungwa Kunaka. So Fungwa Kunaka says, Minister, welcome. But tomorrow is payday. So I said, tomorrow is payday, okay. How much do we have to pay? He says, $30 million. Then I say, so how much do we have in the bank? $4 million, say. Then I say, where are we going to get the $26 million? Say, we're waiting for
that's
you.
That's your problem now. My goodness.
So I then realized that I'd been set up for failure. So I opened, so the office was partitioned, a small little boardroom, and then a small door that leads to a big office. So I went into the big office and sat on the table and started praying. I said, God, you haven't brought me here to fail.
Mm-hmm.
You can't let me down. Where am I going to get 26 million ogre? That's what I did. I prayed. So I then went to the Prime Minister Morgan. I said, look, my friend, we have to find a plan. And we found a plan.
Wow. That's, you would expect you to perform a miracle yeah.
And
in a day.
And the other thing I realized that day is that I needed a plan.
Mm.
I needed an economic blueprint.
Right.
I needed a strategy. So from that Monday afternoon, I started working on a plan which was ready. In 2 weeks' time, called SMART, you know, worked on it, and it helped me stabilize the economy.
Mm-hmm.
I inherited an economy that was 500 billion percent. By the end of the year, our inflation was -7%. So, miracle.
Well, look at that. Yeah, you did perform miracle. Some miracles yeah. right there. So, Tenda, can you speak a little bit about how you navigate the risks and challenges of being in opposition to the sort of main political establishment?
Yeah, you know, to many people in most states, politics is a vocation that you voluntarily choose.
Mm.
In dominated social formations, in places like Mozambique, Angola, Zambia, much of West Africa, it's a choice between life and death. Your life is under threat, the life of your family is under threat, and you are a constant uninvited guest at prisons.
Mm.
Charges and so forth. I've been charged with treason 2 times. I've been tortured. There have been countless attempts on my life and so forth. I've just spent 4 years in a trial over a frivolous thing until February, 15 February 2024. So it's not a walk in the park.
Right.
Yeah, it's not. So you have to commit. You have to commit. And it's also selfish because you're exposed to pain, your family, you know, your mother, your siblings, and so forth, your children. So it's not a walk in the park. It requires sacrifice. It also requires personal integrity, you know, you know, you can't afford to be off stray.
Mm.
You can't afford to be offside because they'll catch you.
Right.
You can't accept bribes. You can't do anything. So it's a life of sacrifice.
Mm.
It's a life of perseverance. And because you're coming from the opposition, you must be better. You must inspire.
Right.
So I read a lot. I don't sleep before 12 a.m. I don't sleep before 12 a.m. And I read everything. Mm. I try to be encyclopedic. I try to read history, whatnot.
Yeah.
It's hard work. Yeah. It's hard work. It's a life of sacrifice. Would I change it? Would I do anything else? I don't think so. But yeah, it's tough. It's very tough. It's a life of sacrifice.
Yeah.
Life of perseverance. And you have to be mad, I think, to do what we do. Yeah, yeah, you have to. Because, you know, if you have a normal mindset, you can't survive. It's not possible.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. So can you speak a little bit about how you, in the face of censorship and repression, ensure that your voice and those of your supporters are heard? And what are some of the effective strategies that you found have been most useful in mobilizing support domestically and even internationally? How do you navigate that in such a tough space?
I think the things we do it in the name of the people.
Mm.
So if we do our things in the name of the people, we must be with the people. And therefore, we must have connectivity and chemistry and identification of what the people are saying. So fortunately, I've for a long time belonged in an organization, the Movement for Democratic Change, led by a leader, the late and great Morgan Tsvangirai, who had chemistry and alchemy with the people, understood, understood the people. I'm middle class, by virtue that I'm a lawyer and so forth. So sometimes it's easy to disconnect, but if you have a strong institution, and we had a very strong institution with strong structures. Grounded in the working people of Zimbabwe. Remember, the MDC was basically a formation of the working people of Zimbabwe through led by our Federation of Trade Unions, Zimbabwe Congress of Trade Unions. So it was easy, but it's also. But you also don't have to be told by anyone that inflation is bad for people,
right.
Unemployment is bad for people, collapsed public health system, expensive education. So we are basically dealing with fragility and state fail. And as long as you have an answer and can address those things, you're addressing the concerns of the people. And that's what I have stood for. That's what I've been about all my life, and in the 5 years I was in the government of national unity, we demonstrated by stabilizing that economy, growing that economy, making a real difference in the people of Zimbabwe. I can't go into a supermarket in Zimbabwe or walk in a park in Zimbabwe without being flooded by people saying, thank you so much for what we did. We married wives, we built our homes, we bought cars. When you're a finance minister, they appreciate that.
That's what
it's about. And also, I think often people ask me, what is your greatest achievement? And I always say, our greatest achievement is something we didn't do. We didn't steal. Because if we'd stolen and amassed wealth, the people would know, would be caught. Yeah, so yes, we stabilized the economy, but the greatest thing we did was we didn't steal.
That's amazing. Tenda, I'm curious, how do you balance the need for peaceful resistance with the urgency of the challenges that you're facing in Zimbabwe? And what role do you see for non-violent civil disobedience, if we can call it that, in effecting meaningful change? Because I think that's it's a big thing to discuss. You see frustration in people, but you have to almost toe this line. I'm curious to know your thoughts.
Once you make that choice, that only peaceful, constitutional, democratic means is the way to go, then it becomes no brainer.
Mm.
So it's not something that I think about. It's not something that ever tempts me, because it's not a solution. Mm. Violence begets a violence. And all states born out of civil conflict are in a permanent state of crisis, as I'm talking to you right now.
Mm-hmm.
Uganda is a good example. Rwanda is another example. So I don't believe in that. I don't believe in that. So it's no brainer. I think that democratic change can be achieved, but there are certain things you must do, which are elementary. Those things are the following. Number one, you must build a credible alternative that is inclusive, that is democratic, that is legitimacy in the people, that is not elitist and so forth. We did it in the Movement for Democratic Change. So building a credible alternative with a vision, with strategy, is very key. Number two, you must walk the talk. Walking the talk means you must have a strategy at a personal level, at a collective level. You must confront the regime peacefully and democratically. Demonstrations, marches, strikes, stairways are legitimate instruments of the democratic struggle everywhere, all over the world, from Martin Luther King to Raila Odinga in Kenya. They are legitimate instruments of achieving a democratic change. They work. Boycotts.
Mm.
They work. They work. They're tried and tested. Number three, you must have capacity to negotiate with the regime, because what you are trying to do is not a revolution. If you want a revolution, go into the mountains and take up guns.
Mm.
So what you are doing is an evolution.
Mm.
Fighting dictatorship is incremental. You grab something, you beg it, and you live to fight another day. Lastly, you must have a perspective. The struggle for democratic change is not a sprint. It's not a sprint. So there are no Usain Bolts in this struggle.
Mm.
There are marathoners from Kenya, Ethiopia, and Morocco. It's a long distance. So you must know that. You must know that. Nelson Mandela spent 27 years in prison. So it's a long walk to freedom.
Yeah.
You must know that.
Yeah.
You must know that. But there's no substitute for building a credible democratic alternative. There's no substitute for having strategy. There's no substitute for action, for being able to confront the regime, for stretching the regime, for putting a premium on dictatorship.
Mm.
Dictatorship must feel the pain. Dictatorship must be isolated. The cost of dictatorship must be. And then when you do well, you get seats in parliament and so forth. You must protect your zones of autonomy. And when those zones of autonomy, you must deliver. So if you are controlling a council, that council must deliver.
Yeah.
If you are, like we did, going to government, you must perform and deliver. You must show that you are the hope that the people are aspiring to.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore your personal conduct is critical.
Incredible.
It's critical.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're carrying the hopes of millions and millions of people.
I have two questions that come from that. And the first one, Tenda, is something I hear a lot of when I talk to young people. And the numbers are starting to show, if you look at some of these polling and things, the quote-unquote sort of demographic that is more, if I can call, autocratic in some sense, are younger people. And I hear this a lot when they say democracy is not for Africa. And I think underlying a lot of this is because the existing models, which on paper are sort of democratic, although I don't think they always function that way, have failed a lot of people. And so that's why they feel that way. I'm curious to know what your thoughts are and what your message is to young people coming up who've seen their parents being failed by these systems, who are seeing these systems fail them and think that it's democracy that's the problem and that's not something that African countries should be practicing.
Well, look, we have to accept that post-liberation constructions that have taken over the state from liberation constructs or post-liberation constructs like military coups, we have to accept that quite a few of them, upon taking office, have betrayed the cause of the masses and have reproduced themselves asymmetrical to their antithesis. In other words, they've just fallen into the shoes of the erstwhile.
They just swapped faces.
So if you look at Malawi, a lot of people are questioning what President Chakwera is doing. And there are many, you know, there are many examples that I can give without naming. So that obviously has created a cynicism. I was in the Democratic Republic of Congo a few years ago when Joseph Kabila Jr. was the president.
Yeah.
And I tell you, they now have songs. Rumba artists are now singing in Lingali saying, "We miss old Mobutu Sese Seko," because of the failures and weaknesses of, there is no substitute to democracy. And democracy is self-correcting. There's no better system at self-correcting than democracy. But a lot of these young people actually don't comprehend what democracy is. It's choice. These kids are on Instagram, they are on Snapchat, they are on Facebook, a few of them are on Twitter. It is your choice to post a picture when you are in a red dress or a red trouser. It's choice. It's that choice. And democracy is that elementary. It's that crude. The capacity to make choices. So a lot of them, you know, the human has got short memories. There's no substitute for democracy.
And the majority of sort of our young population are people under 30. So in a lot of places, we don't exactly have living memory of some of the times past.
No, they've not seen what we have seen. They've not seen the ugly. But it's not permanent. I mean, if you talk about surveys, those surveys as well will also tell you that the majority of Africans
prefer
democracy.
Yeah.
And that is fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is fact.
But there's also the increasing tendency for what we're seeing, as they are saying, when the government is failing, a military regime is preferable, which is another shocking finding from recent sort of polling across the continent.
In my country, thousands of people, if not millions, came out to demonstrate against Robert Mugabe and to welcome the military on the 18th of November, 2017. So it's not the first time that the masses will come out to celebrate the military. We've seen it in Niger. We've seen it in Burkina Faso. We've seen it in Mali, and
Niger.
In Niger, we saw it as well when Odimba fell a few months ago in the Gambia. It's natural. The problem is when democratic outlets are closed.
Yeah,
people will celebrate anything that destroys the status quo, irrespective of how undemocratic it is.
Mm.
But the problem is they don't know that which they are celebrating is in Zimbabwe. We have a saying that says, "Uno fariranganga nino bata mai." So you celebrate a witch doctor who is going to say your mother is the witch in the village. So that's what we are doing.
Mm.
You know. The military is not a force of democracy. The military is the opposite of the democracy.
Mm.
But it's a sign of the failure of civilian rules.
Yeah.
That the military suddenly becomes a renaissance, suddenly appears it's an indictment.
Mm-hmm.
It's an indictment.
Yeah. Indeed. So as we round this up, I wanted to know what lessons have you learned over the course of, your years doing this, from your journey, that you believe are important to share with others who are also striving for justice and freedom?
So I would say that the struggle for democracy, the struggle for democratization, for decolonization, don't invent a new will. Stick to the basics. What are the basics? Number one, the chemistry and alchemy with the people, because we do it in the name of the people.
Mm.
So, the people, the citizen power, citizen agency and agents is critical. So that's number one. Number two, there must be the organization, the structure. A democratic, inclusive vehicle is necessary. And speaking of an organization, you must work together.
Mm.
So coalitions, broad alliances are inevitable and necessary when you are fighting autocracy. Because oftentimes, none of you can be strong to dismantle a dictatorship. Even if one party might be bigger than others, people like the idea that people are able to work together.
Yeah.
Because when you work together, you give and take. And people like want give and take.
Mm.
Because give and take is tolerance. And it's a sign of things to come, that you can work together, you're inclusive and you're tolerant. Number three, you must have the strategy. You must have the strategy. Number four, you must have action.
Mm.
These things are not elitist. They're not boardroom.
Mm-hmm.
You must be on the street, confronting, petitioning, demonstrating, boycotting, and so forth. It's allowed by the constitution. Do it. Do it. And then you must have perception, as I've said. It's a long-term struggle.
Right.
Long-term struggle. But you must also, because oftentimes why we don't do well when we take over the state is that we have no plan the morning after.
Yes.
We have a plan of dislodging. And I think that's what the MDC did very well when we entered the government of national unity.
Yeah.
Because we had started thinking about governance when we were... So we spent a lot of time investing on policy.
Important, yeah.
We spent a lot of time investing on policy. I told you that I wrote SMART in 2 weeks. But strictly speaking, that's not true. I, in fact, had written SMART 4 years before, in 2004, when I wrote the MDC blueprint, Restart. We wrote an economic blueprint called Restart.
Mm.
And I kept on improving it over the years. So think about the future. Think about the future. So scenario planning, little strategy meetings, etc., they are key. They are key. It's as much a physical struggle as it is a cerebral struggle.
Right.
So you have to have that balance of boardroom thinking and physical thinking. And in 2008, we got it right.
Mm-hmm.
So when I got into the stage as finance minister, I had ideas.
Yeah.
I had ideas. And I knew, for instance, that what had killed our economies, the Zimbabwean economy at least, was the printing of money. Printing of money. Inflation got to 500 billion percent. And when you print money, you are spending that which you don't have.
Mm.
So my catchword became, we eat what we kill. We eat what we kill. If we kill a rat, we eat a rat. We can't kill a rat and then eat an elephant. The elephant doesn't belong to us, and it's imposing a burden on future generations.
Mm.
So yeah. Planning is very important.
Yeah.
I went to Kenya in May, May 2008.
Mm.
I went into Prime Minister Raila Odinga's office. It was his first day in office.
Oh.
And he confessed with me that, look, we don't have a plan. And they had no plan. The first thing that they did was to allow free education, which they didn't have money. So scenario planning is so key. You have a long-term a future.
Yeah.
It's important because you can be caught napping.
Yeah.
And when you are caught napping, you disappoint the citizen because you have no plan.
You have no
plan. Fortunately, we had a plan.
Yeah. And I can't understate that because, you know, a while ago I was writing this piece and from the research, I'm like, it seems like a lot of opposition parties, the goal is just to, quote unquote, you know, remove the current one. But what they do when they come and they have no idea. So
and also they overpromise. They're populists. They overpromise.
They're trying to win an election.
The phrase, they say you campaign in poetry and you govern in prose. That's what created disjuncture.
Indeed.
That's what created disjuncture.
Yeah.
Campaign in poetry, govern in poetry. It's doable if you have a plan.
Hmm.
Don't create expectations. Don't create expectations. Don't create things you can't do. But there are things we can do. We can grow economies.
Mm-hmm.
During my time, the Zimbabwean economy grew on average by they're now saying 19%, but it was the World Bank says 11%. The most sustained that any other country has ever done it. And we were able to do it because we were tenacious and we had almost like a religious zeal in execution and performance. And that is important.
Important. And Tanda, you mentioned before the importance of building like alliances and coalitions. I think in a lot of places where they are trying to build some of these credible democratic alternatives, trying to work together with, I mean, you would have to work together with existing little groups as well. I'm curious to know if you have 2 to 3 sort of guiding principles for people who are looking to build some of these democratic alternatives, but also how they go into partnership with other people around them. If you were to provide 2 to 3 guiding principles to think about building and developing these relationships, what would you say about that? I think you mentioned some of them yesterday, but I'm curious to...
So number one, the idea of coalitions and alliances is to inspire the population, is to carry the population with you. Oftentimes, the political landscape is divided on tribal lines,
yeah,
on regional lines, in some cases on class lines, but that is fast ending. So when you come together, you are bringing everyone together, whether it's tribal, whether it's regional. So, and people want that. People want a team. So the principle of an alliance and coalition must be understood that it's not for the actors, it's for the citizen, it's for the Wananchi, it's for the Walanawoi. Number two, you must build alliances and coalitions on certain principles. One of them is respect. There can be hubris. If one party or one individual thinks I'm bigger than the others, or more important, then you have a problem. Then you have a problem. In fact, alliances that have worked is that the biggest party or the biggest individual has oftentimes been the humblest. And I saw it with Morgan Tsvangirai during his time. So there must be humility and respect by everyone. Number three, you must pay attention to detail. So your constituent documents must cover everything. Don't leave anything to discretion. If it's a pre-election coalition, you must agree on which party will take which seats, you can't leave that to chance. Don't leave it to discretion. So you must pay attention to discretion. Number four is that coalitions are bringing together competitors and rivalries.
Yeah.
it's not a marriage where someone says I do and the other person says I do. It's not that. So you must build coalitions not on trust, but actually on mistrust.
That's an interesting point of view.
Because when you build on trust, you give too much discretion, you trust each other.
Mm.
So when you build a coalition and an alliance based on mistrust, you are already saying this one might betray me. So when you have that mindset, you then vaccinate against that in the documents,
yeah.
In the coalition documents. They become stronger, they become sustainable. Number four, your alliance must resonate with the people.
Mm.
Your alliance must resonate with the people. So, whilst you must avoid hubris, but you must also recognize, so for instance, I take Kenya. There are many coalitions that always happen in Kenya. But you can't ignore a party that is strong, let's say in Kikuyu land, and say we're going to put party Y, which has no resonance in that area.
Mm-hmm.
So you must always take the people with you when you have a nest and honesty. So whilst hubris is totally unnecessary, you must also, over ambition is also a problem.
Mm-hmm.
Is also a problem. Mm-hmm. Then lastly, you must have a strategy. If it's a pre-election, a coalition, you must have answers. What will happen when you actually win?
Mm.
What will happen if you don't win but you're in parliament?
Mm.
Who is going to be the leader of the opposition? Who is going to be your chief whips? Don't leave those things to chance.
Mm.
Cover them.
Yeah.
Then a lot of coalitions or alliances are short-term. They are short-term in the sense that they are designed for a particular election or a particular term. You can't go into a marriage and expect it to last 3 years. It will then die immediately. You are undermining yourself. Try as much as possible to make it as long-term as possible. When everyone feels secure and safe, then there is less capacity to be capricious, to be malicious, and so try to make it long term.
Mm.
Avoid a one station mindset. This is a coalition for this election, or this is a coalition for the next 5 years when we are governing. You have a problem.
Mm.
Try to say, if we have to go for another term, what will we do? Lay the foundations for that. Create the foundations for future working together.
Mm.
That way you then minimize competition, you then minimize opportunism, you then minimize malice.
Yeah, well, thank you for sharing that. So as we round this up, looking ahead, I have a two-part question. One, what are your hopes for your country, Zimbabwe? And the second question is, when you think about Africa in 2050, 2060, what comes to mind? What are your aspirations for it? What are your concerns for it?
For Zimbabwe, I think our country needs democratization. 44 years is too much.
Hmm.
In 44 years, we've only known two presidents, Robert Mugabe and Emmerson Mnangagwa. That's terrible. South Africa, that attained democratic governance 30 years ago, he has had 4 or 5 presidents in that period. President Mandela, President Mbeki, President Zuma, 5 presidents, Cyril, 6 presidents, Namibia, same, Zambia, they've had Chiluba, they've had, so it's a pity. We need to democratize Zimbabwe. And we can only democratize Zimbabwe if we in the opposition get our house to in order.
Mm.
We need a new inclusive opposition that is broad based, that brings back the institution, the trade unions, the church, people in the diaspora and so forth. ZANU-PF has put a price on our country. ZANU-PF has put a premium on our country, and it's time that we had real sustainable democratic change. As far as Africa is concerned, I'm really worried about Africa.
Why is that?
Because of the clear, self-evident democratic recession and devaluation that has taken place on the African continent. Look at the MENA region. Look at what is happening in Tunisia. Look at what is happening in Libya. Look at what is happening in Egypt. Look at what is happening in the Sahel. Look at what is happening in Sudan. In South Sudan, I don't know why we call it a state. Look at what is happening in Ethiopia. Look at what is happening in the Horn of Africa, in Somaliland, Mogadishu, in Djibouti.
West Africa.
West, look at the coups in West Africa. Six or so in the last 18 months in Mali, in Niger, in Burkina Faso. Look at Ouattara in Cote d'Ivoire. Look at Ngansibe Eyadema in Togo. It's a dog's breakfast, but one which not many dogs would want. Look at Cameroon and brother Paul Biya. Look at Equatorial Guinea and Obiang. I come to East Africa. Look at Museveni. He has just appointed his son as general. He wants him to take over. Look at Chama Chama Pinduzi in Tanzania. Look at the Democratic Republic of Congo. Look at stolen elections in Angola, Southern Africa. Look at what is happening in Botswana, of all places, as Zimbabwe, Mozambique, and so forth. So Africa is very worrying. I've not even mentioned the Central African Republic. Why do we call it a republic? So it's a dog's breakfast. So I'm really worried about Africa. I think that thinking with my head, I think the balance sheet in 2050 is going to be very bad. Thinking with my heart, I hope it will be more democratic, but I think my head is correct. It will be a sadder situation. Autocrats and authoritarian consolidation will be the order of the day, but the challenges are going to be huge. By 2050, Africa's population would have been doubled, but we are not creating enough jobs for that. So there will be a demographic implosion, and Africa will be much poorer in 2050 than it is now, because we are not transforming these economies the way we should be. That's why me and my friends have worked a lot on the Asian experience and how it can be used to inspire African states to develop exponentially. Our economies are growing at around an average of 4% in the last decade. But to budget for the demographic implosion, we need to be having growth rates three times that of 12%. Mm-hmm. There's no African economy that is... South Africa, the biggest economy, 500 billion GDP, it's limping at 1%, 1.5%. Nigeria, biggest economy, it's limping at around 2%. Who is the president of Nigeria? A certain gerontocratic called Mr. Tinubu, who can't even walk. What a joke. What a shame.
Tendai, what do you have to say to young people? People like me, people younger than me, whose
reality... The future doesn't belong to you. Yeah. The present belongs to you. Get into these political organizations, into NGOs. Anyone who tells you that the future belongs to you is lying.
They are lying to us.
He's being selfish.
It's the present.
Get into these spaces. It is the present. It is the present. It is the present. So get into these things and grab the fights. Your fights are very clear. Number one, the issue of democratization. I call them 5 Ds. The issue of democratization, the issue of development, the issue of the environment, decarbonization, the issue of data. That's the future. Those 5 Ds, that's the future. So get into them now.
Tendai, this has been fantastic. It's everything I imagined it would be. Thank you again for sitting with me today.
That brings us to the end of today's show. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did putting it together. I love learning new things. Hey, if you enjoyed this chat, you definitely enjoy others that came before it. Check out previous episodes on whichever platform you're tuned into now, or visit our website www.thebrenthurstfoundation.org for other episodes. As always, thank you so much for listening. And if I could make one last ask of you, please do share this with others. Again, you're listening to Marie Noel on the Brenthurst Foundation podcast, and it's been a pleasure sharing this time with you. Until next week, stay well.